From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
I'm Tom Young with the Broadcast Podcast Committee of the National Press Club. Over the past year or so, reporters in the U.S. have faced unprecedented challenges. Virtually all, the Pentagon Press Corps was expelled from the building because journalists would not sign a pledge to report only information approved by the government. Journalist Don Lemon was arrested after he covered a protest where demonstrators entered a Minnesota church. The White House barred Associated Press reporters from certain events because the AP would not call the Gulf of Mexico by President Trump's preferred name, the Gulf of America. More recently, the Pentagon has barred news photographers from press briefings. Those are just a few examples. Against that backdrop, it's a tough time economically for the American press. The Washington Post recently cut about a third of its workforce. Local newspapers across the country have trimmed staff or closed altogether. So, what does all that mean for the health of a free press? Can a U.S. audience still count on accurate, unrestrained reporting? And do they even want that? Joining me in the studio from the Committee to Protect Journalists is Catherine Jacobson. Catherine is CPJ's U.S., Canada, and Caribbean Program Coordinator. Catherine worked in Moscow for the AP. She also reported as a freelancer in Ukraine, and her writing has appeared in Business Week, U.S. News and World Report, and other media. Glad to have you with us, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is former National Press Club President Myron Belkin. Myron had a storied four-decade career with the AP. His assignments included serving as bureau chief in New Delhi, London, and Tokyo, and as a correspondent in Kuala Lumpur. Before going overseas, he was an editor in New York on the international desk. After his AP career, he taught for 18 years as a professorial lecturer at the George Washington University School of Media and Public Affairs. Full disclosure, I also worked for the AP for 10 years, and Myron and I are both members of the Press Club's American Legion post. So good to see you again, Myron.
Likewise.
I'll start with a question for Catherine. Her organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, works on behalf of reporters all over the world, including those imprisoned or threatened for practicing journalism. Recently, CBJ announced an emergency fund to support U.S. journalists at risk. Catherine, tell us about this fund. What does it do?
The Committee to Protect Journalists and the International Women's Media Foundation created this fund that you're talking about with local partners in Minnesota to help meet the needs that journalists on the ground are facing while covering ramped up activity for around immigration enforcement in the area. And what we've been seeing, not just in the past month or since the beginning of the year as far as demands from journalists, but as this longer arc of reporters in the United States really facing demands that I think previously, a decade ago, we would have thought unimaginable. The fact that reporters on the ground in Minnesota and across the United States really are going into protest situations, really, you know, needing to have gear out that previously in the United States you wouldn't have thought that journalists would need bulletproof vests and a helmet when simply going out to cover a protest. It speaks to the fact that we're in a different safety paradigm in the United States, and you know, the need for protecting reporters has changed. It's not just policy and advocacy; it's also something, you know, more tangible. It's the safety kit as well that reporters need.
Well, speaking of the safety paradigm and the safety kit, I've always thought of CPJ as an advocate for reporters in dangerous countries that don't even pretend to have a free press. But during my own time in journalism, and this was in the 80s and 90s, I never worried about my physical safety, except maybe when covering natural disasters. So can you elaborate a bit more on just how things have changed since that time and the kinds of, safety gear that reporters are finding themselves needing nowadays?
Yeah, so this paradigm shift, I think, has happened before now, right? It's not just in the past year with the Trump administration. It's something that the second Trump administration, I should say. It's something that we've been seeing this kind of steady drumbeat as the police have been increasingly militarized in the United States. you have less safe protest situations, right? Less safe protest situations, journalists are at greater risk. And also all of this happening with increased rhetoric against the media, it creates this kind of perfect storm of targeted attacks against reporters from law enforcement in a way that we hadn't really previously seen. So what that does, to get to your question, is that creates a situation where journalists physically are not as safe to be able to go out and cover these events in the way that we would have hoped. For CPJ, the watershed moment was really in 2020 with the Black Lives Matter protests, when we saw an unprecedented number of attacks against the press, targeted attacks even, right? And we kind of had a lull in protest activity after that. And what we've seen now is, with the second Trump administration, an increase in protests, especially around immigration policy, and thus an increase in less safe reporting situations, and with that, an increase in attacks against the media.
Well, speaking of reporters' safety and CPJ's safety kit for journalists, I understand that that kit addresses both physical and digital threats. Tell us about the digital piece.
Yeah, so unfortunately, digital threats are kind of par for the course now for journalists. With the advent of the internet, right, we also saw a rise in the number and the types of digital harassment against members of the media. Women and journalists of color traditionally face more attacks online than others. And what's really concerning about those is, not only is it rhetoric online that disincentivizes those groups especially from continuing to report and having a plurality of voices, which is very important to creating a robust media ecosystem with different perspectives, it's also really scary because you don't know when those online attacks can actually spill over into the real world and have actual physical consequences. And no one wants to be the outlier when that actually happens.
Myron, you've reported from all over the world, and you've seen how a free press does or does not operate in various countries. Here in the U.S., do things feel different to you now, or are we just seeing more of the tension that always exists between government and the media?
Well, for four decades, I covered the news abroad, and in many times saw governments crack down on the press, saw the press get endangered and curtailed from the way they could report. Moving back to America at age 64, I didn't think I would ever see circumstances develop in the United States where the press would be under assault in various ways. I think the tone was set in January of 2017, the month that President Trump began his first term, and he described the press as an enemy of the American people, his exact words, and I double-checked that before we started the podcast. So the tone has been set by the president, and I think the press still has enshrined the First Amendment, which grants freedom of the press and freedom of the speech to the American public, but we have to recognize that there are various hurdles being put in our way. You give examples of, like, even for the Pentagon reporters, how they were restricted in a way that many representatives of leading organizations said they couldn't abide by the new guidelines. So it is, I'd say, very tough times. We are still protected by another landmark ruling of the Supreme Court in 1964. Which is known as Times versus Sullivan, when it was upheld that to encourage robust public debate and coverage, that if any public official wanted to sue the press, they would have to prove that there was absolute malice, deliberate attempt to misrepresent the facts. And that has been upheld. But just let me just say, in 2014, when I was president of the Press Club, we had two distinguished justices appear for the Kalb report that you mentioned earlier. And Marvin Kalb asked both Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia if the case was relitigated of Times versus Sullivan today, which was declared unanimously by the court in 64, how would they vote in 2014, or if it would come up in their lifetimes. And Justice Ginsburg said she would continue to support that ruling. And Justice Scalia said he would oppose it. So times are changing. And we, every day, we see hurdles to the press being allowed to cover as freely as they once did. There's the assault of and the threat of judicial suits, you know, to tie up a lot of funds of media organizations. So it is tough times.
To look at where this could lead, perhaps it's instructive to look at what has happened in other countries. So what was the biggest challenge you faced as a foreign correspondent regarding freedom of the press?
The morning and overnight of June 25th, 1975. I had been based in India almost continuously since 66 in what was the largest, recognized as the largest democracy in the world with the largest free press.
In India.
In India. And overnight that changed. Mrs. Gandhi had been convicted of an electoral malpractice related to the funding of her last election campaign. And the court ruled against her. And massive protests began almost immediately and led up to, I think the judgment against her was like, I'd say around June 12th. And on the night of June 25th, I got a tip off from some very good Indian journalists who wanted to be sure the story got out to the world through the AP, even if they couldn't do it locally. And it was that opposition leaders were being arrested. And stand by. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, Mrs. Gandhi went on All India Radio and declared a state of emergency when civil liberties were suspended, freedom of the press was curtailed, and many opposition leaders were arrested. And I had what we would call, in those days, we didn't have the sat phones and like you do today and mobile phones, but I had a leased teleprinter circuit from AP New Delhi to AP London that actually I had installed when Richard Nixon visited India in 1969. And I remember saying to New York, let's keep this leased circuit because I don't have to then go through potential bureaucracy at the cable office, the post office. And so that night I sat there, I was all alone, and I had very good sources, including the support of the Indian National News Agency that kept putting out the news until just after Mrs. Gandhi spoke, got a phone call from Harry DePena. Harry was a good friend. He had been the chief information officer of the Indian government. And he called to tell me he had a new title, Chief Censor. Chief
Wow.
Censor. And he said, Myron, all your dispatches now need to go through my office. Well, that did not work. The Indian information officers did not know what to do. But the Indian government started expelling Western journalists who they had almost targeted that they didn't like, mainly visiting journalists. So I had the good fortune or the bad fortune to be that year the president of the Foreign Correspondents Association of South Asia in New Delhi. And we had a meeting. And there were a number of journalists who said, we can't tolerate this. We should leave in protest. And I consulted with the AP and I said, we don't leave. We stay and do our reporting as best we can, with the proviso that if any of our dispatches were censored, we would say so in the heading of the story. But I was decided to lead a delegation of the foreign correspondents of South Asia. We decided, let's just go to the home of the information minister. And V.C. Shukla was his name. And so about 8 in the morning one day, there I was. I showed up with a delegation, unannounced. And a servant came out, and I introduced ourselves. We wanted to meet the information minister. And he went back into the bungalow and came out and said, the minister will see you as soon as he finishes his morning bath. And so V.C. Shukla came out, and I said, Mr. Minister, this is not working. If you want coverage of India we can't have this pre-censorship. And he said he would get back to us. And what he got back to us through the government was that they would lift the pre-censorship for the foreign correspondents while keeping it for the domestic press. We had to sign a set of guidelines that I looked at what I considered the key paragraph, which was ensure that your reports are accurate. And so whenever we would have a discussion with the chief censor's office and something, I would just point the fact that was accurate. And then the last time I recall being called in to the chief censor's office with my friend Harry, he would always invite me for a cup of chai, cup of tea, good Indian tea. And he said, Myron, we're particularly worried about your bureau because the dispatches you send around the world also go to neighboring Pakistan. And we're worried that if you send out a story based on false rumors about communal violence on the border with Pakistan, that could lead to a major conflagration on the border. And I stopped Harry and I said, Harry, if I ever put out, or any of my staff in New Delhi, put out a story based on false rumors, yes, the Indian government will expel me, but the Associated Press will fire me because they have zero tolerance for fabricated stories. And I think that was the last time I saw him. And then the emergency was lifted in March 77. Again, in the middle of the night, Mrs. Gandhi drove to the Rashtrapati Bhavan, the presidential home of the Indian head of state, to resign after she had been soundly defeated.
Wow, wow.
So that was still like yesterday, I remember that. It was unexpected. You know, to go overnight from the world's largest democracy to the world's largest then authoritarian state.
Wow. Well, you've certainly seen some extremes, which leads me to the next question. When you came in from the field and entered academia, what did you tell your students about the kind of environments they could face when they graduated?
I began each lecture over those 18 years in two ways. One, when they would come in, they would see on the whiteboard, sometimes it might have been the blackboard, but I had written the letters RAF. And I said to the class, that's the way I began my first lecture when I was teaching in London while being AP bureau chief. I was offered a chance. I had a call from Webster University in St. Louis saying, as the AP bureau chief, could you recommend somebody to teach our basic journalism course? And my brain went back to my days at Ohio State as an undergraduate when the late George Kinzel said, Myron, go get a master's degree at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, which I'm pleased Catherine is also an alum of, and so that you could teach one day. So when I got that call, I thought, I'll keep my word to the late George Kinzel. So I said to the class, that RAF does not stand for the Royal Air Force, but it stands for what I consider the three credos of American of journalism worldwide, to report responsibly, accurately, and fairly. That is a constant theme, and people, the students in there, I didn't know that you got, they did report cards about their professors, but when I start getting them, they would say they love the RAF lecture. So I would also tell the students at every lecture, this is from, as you said, from 2005 to 2023, a time of continuing major job cutbacks. I would also say, after telling them about RAF, I would tell them that why I am often asked, would I want to teach journalism at a time of tremendous tens of thousands of job losses? And I said, I teach journalism because there is still a major, major role for journalism. And indeed, I know among the job cutbacks, which were horrific and terrible for those who had to suffer them, there are, with the growth of digital journalism, actually more opportunities now for new areas from which to get into journalism. In my youth, to come to Washington, you would have to wait, maybe spend years earlier in your career in other cities before you come to Washington. Now we get many young graduate newly graduated members of the Press Club who have come here because of new opportunities in journalism, in other fields. And then my favorite mantra is that what these basic tenets of journalism about accuracy and reporting that you learn in journalism will help you in any profession you go into. And so we have many journalists who go on to other professions, but they succeed because of those writing skills that they learned in basic journalism.
Definitely, absolutely.
So I'm the eternal optimist, even among horrendous cutbacks.
Well, there's always a place for accurate writing. One of the ways media have come under pressure lately is lawsuits or threats of lawsuits about who gets interviewed and even how those interviews are edited. We touched on this briefly earlier, but last year, Paramount Global paid $16 million to settle a lawsuit from President Trump over how it edited an interview, not with Trump, but with former Vice President Kamala Harris. So, Myron, what do you think this kind of thing means for press freedom?
Well, I think it's a tactic of not only the current administration, but even other outside organizations, corporations, you know, who are unhappy with coverage. And they know that a lawsuit could cost billions. And so you try to curtail the press by curtailing their funding. It is dangerous. But it is essential that media organizations, major newspapers, and even smaller ones, that when they are standing by and are satisfied with the accuracy of their coverage, they should not give in to the threat of a lawsuit. They need to fight it. And happily, there are many very good First Amendment lawyers. But just to settle even before it goes to trial, I think, is a dangerous precedent that will only encourage, be it the government or other organizations, corporations, to silence the press with the mere threat of a lawsuit.
Well, speaking of that kind of censorship or self-censorship as a result of lawsuits and so forth, recently Stephen Colbert said he recorded a late show interview with Democratic Senate candidate James Tallarico, but CBS lawyers told him he couldn't air it. CBS, for its part, said the late show was given what it called legal guidance, but not prohibited from running the interview. Catherine, are you seeing more of this kind of self-censorship?
Certainly. I mean, it's difficult to quantify the stories that aren't told, right? But what we do know, especially as a global organization, right, that when one type of speech is censored or discouraged, it very much bleeds over into freedom of the press. The example that keeps on coming to mind with the Colbert scenario whenever it comes up is in Russia, the same thing happened with a TV show called Kukli, right, or Puppets, that Vladimir Putin did not particularly care for and was ushered off the air, right? And so let's look at what happened in Russia. Not great. We do not want the same thing to happen in the United States. Not to say that we're following the exact same pattern, right? Comparative politics only goes so far. But at the same time, it's, I think, quite logical to think that when the administration has such thin skin when it comes to any sort of negative coverage, whether that be in the sphere of comedy or in reporting, that eventually creates an atmosphere where reporters and newsrooms and news corporations are more hesitant to tell difficult stories that might receive pushback, whether financial or just, you know, in other forms, from this administration. And I think the really important point that we need to think about beyond just, you know, what this means for the industry is what it means for the American people and globally as well, right? When you do not have, you know, fact-based forms of information that are being distributed and people have more difficulty accessing that type of information, you have a less informed public, you have less civic engagement, sometimes poor civic engagement, and you ultimately have, you know, a government that is not being held to account, right? Journalists are here to hold the government to account, to perform the role of the fourth estate. And we as Americans are paying taxes, and the government is being funded by our taxpayer dollars. And without any sort of accountability, it means that, you know, our hard-earned money is being spent to do things that we might not fully be able to understand because we don't have any sort of accountability mechanism.
Well, speaking of the different kinds of specific threats to press freedom, in January, the FBI conducted a search of a Washington Post reporter's home, reportedly as part of a leak investigation. So this is another question for Catherine. How often have you seen that kind of thing, searches of reporters' homes and offices?
At some point in time this year, I need to come up with a synonym for unprecedented. Currently, I do not have one. It was unprecedented to see this type of action in the United States, right? My international colleagues and I were talking about it, and it's, again, stuff that we have seen overseas. But to have that happen in a democracy in the United States, which has prided itself on being kind of the pillar of press freedom, is really, I think, difficult and damaging in ways that, again, are difficult to quantify at this stage. To have the FBI show up to a journalist's home and seize her devices and now have an ongoing legal battle, which not only takes away time and energy, but also discourages any sources from reaching out to that reporter or indeed many other reporters, fearful that a similar type of action could take place against them. It's damaging beyond our imagination in a way, right? To kind of go back to it, it might seem like a one-off case or insider baseball in DC, but it's not, right? Like, you have a reporter that hundreds of, you know, people have trusted to maintain their anonymity, and that journalist wanted to do just that, and the federal government grossly overstepped what its powers and decided to use that journalist to try and find out more information in a leak case. And that really just, you know, smacks in the face of legal precedent and a general understanding of how journalists should be able to protect those sources.
Absolutely. Given the proliferation of all kinds of cable TV shows, YouTube programs, and podcasts, if you like, you could find an echo chamber that tells you only what you want to hear. So I'll put this question to both of you. Do you feel most Americans even want a robust free press at all? I'll start with Catherine.
I like to think so. I think most Americans want to have fact-based information, and most Americans want to have communities that are pleasant to live in. They want to have good schools and roads that don't have potholes in them, you know, eggs that aren't astronomically expensive, and gas that, you know, doesn't cost $5 a gallon. So how do we get there, I think, is the question. And where do journalists fit into keeping people informed about what's going on? So journalists are essential for explaining why all of these things are changing, why things are more expensive, why your community isn't what you want it to be, right? And why your federal government isn't enacting policies that perhaps you voted for. And so do Americans want a free press? Perhaps they wouldn't phrase it as such, but I think ultimately they want to live in a good society, in a country that allows them to meet their needs, to have, you know, a happy and comfortable life. And so, yes, I think journalists are an essential part of that. And so I would argue that, yes, Americans do want a free press, just perhaps, you know, maybe they would not articulate it as such. But at its core, when you look at what builds that good society, then, yes, they do.
So, Myron, what's your take on this? Do you feel that most Americans value press freedom as much as those of us in the press club value press freedom?
I would like to say yes, but I have to admit, sadly, that times have changed. I'll just go back to the 1950s when I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. That city had three major daily newspapers, as did many other major metropolitan areas. Now in Cleveland, as sadly in the case of many other cities, there's only one paper, the Plain Dealer. And even that, I don't think, is distributed home delivery every day. So in those days, people naturally read papers and other publications that they read because they were expected to see all sides of a story. Now that has changed, and people are buying or reading the outlets that agree with their views. But somehow we have to pierce that, and you pierce that with good basic reporting that breaks news. We've seen this on the Washington Post, were major cutbacks that you mentioned in your very good introduction. But what I'm objectively looking at the Washington Post is their hard news staff is still breaking stories, even those that are unfavorable to the government and maybe unfavorable to Jeff Bezos, the publisher. So it comes back to what we learned in school, if we went to journalism school, or what we learned on the job in our first publications. What counts is solid, accurate reporting, irrespective of who is the target, not a target in a way of a shooting, but who is the target of the investigation. So it just comes back to what I say is that RAF, essential for responsible, accurate, and fair reporting, to show the general population the importance of news.
If I could just add something to that, I perhaps spend too much time on social media trying to understand how people are consuming news. And one thing that I've saw that has really kind of given me hope is, you know, this young influencer with hundreds of thousands of followers who just discovered this really cool print magazine. And it's so much less stressful and so much more informative, she was saying, to read this and to have something that didn't feel like it was screaming at her through the screen, and instead be able to consume information about her community in that way. And I do think that with younger generations, maybe I just hope, but I also think that there will and is this kind of back, will be and is this kind of backlash against this flood of information that we're getting on social media that's, you know, very much one-sided because of algorithms sometimes.
And I think there is, you know, again, the optimistic side of what I'm saying is the growth of more journalistic opportunities. But you mentioned the social media. I worry about there is a danger of having anybody with a couple $100 iPhone or comparable device, they could go out and publish whatever they want without the fact-checking and with the danger of misinformation spreading. And that is really, I don't want to, a cancer in the field that we have to recognize is a major danger. That anybody, when I got out of college in the early 60s, it was the goal of many of our idealistic journalism students to own your own newspaper. But to do that, you would have to have a couple $1 million in 1960s prices to go out and buy a printing press. Now, a couple $100 handheld device, you're a publisher. And so we have to somehow ensure that there is a mechanism that when people lose their credibility, they're going to lose their readership, their viewership. So that is my worry for the future, that anybody can go out and, if you like, shout fire, and we have a problem. So it's incumbent that, in particularly the newer generation, that as they go into their own social media, that they recognize the tenets of the RAF, which gives our profession its only credibility.
That's a good point about media literacy. That's a challenge for the audience now that probably didn't exist in the 50s and 60s. Right. You could pick up a newspaper and assume it was pretty reliable, but you see a post on social media, you have to be savvy enough to know where that post came from and whether it's credible.
And we have, in as you mentioned, you know, governments anywhere in the world, they want to project their best light. But we have increasingly governments that are putting out misinformation. And a good journalist has to point that out.
Exactly.
And it comes back to fact-based. I mean, I'm retired from the AP now for 20 years, but I'm proud that the AP builds itself, describes itself as a fact-based journalism. And I know others outlets do too. We're fortunate to have some major papers that are following that, and long may that continue. But it's easy to say, yes, we have freedom of the press. It's enshrined in the First Amendment. But let us remember that there are major hurdles and obstacles where there are people and governments wanting to alter that view.
That's a good point. We have to use freedom of the press and defend freedom of the press.
Well said.
We've been talking with former National Press Club president and longtime AP correspondent Myron Belkin and Catherine Jacobson with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Myron and Catherine, thank you so much for your time. I'm Tom Young, reporting for Update One from the National Press Club in Washington.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.